starting pitchers, and fantasy baseball research. I'll talk with Nick Pollock of PitcherList.com and Ed DiCaria of BaseballHQ.com next on Baseball HQ Radio.
Learn to play the winner's way, because Baseball HQ Radio starts right now. And here's your host from BaseballHQ.com, columnist Patrick Davitt.
And welcome to Baseball HQ Radio for Tuesday, March the 19th. It's show number 7 of the 2024 fantasy baseball season. I am Patrick Davitt, your host, and we do have another great Two Tout Tuesday edition for you. We'll have two feature expert interviews with Nick Pollock from PitcherList.com, discussing some of the starting pitchers he's been talking about over at his site, like Eury Pérez of Miami, Anthony DeSclafani of Minnesota, and Cody Bradford of Texas. And we'll talk about some of the rotations he's addressed, including the Orioles, Angels, and Pirates. And he'll have some starting pitcher boons and banes. Then in our second expert interview, Ed DiCaria and I will talk about what makes good fantasy baseball research. We'll talk about adjustments to Baseball HQ's PQS metric for starting pitchers and Ed's own groundbreaking work on assessing playing time. It's another big Two Tout Tuesday edition. Thanks for joining us at Baseball HQ Radio. Hey, what do you say? We have Nick Pollock. We have Ed DiCaria. We have to talk some baseball. And in the first inning of this Two Tout Tuesday edition, it's feature expert interview number one with Nick Pollock from PitcherList.com. Nick, welcome to Baseball HQ Radio.
What is happening? Thank you so much for having me, Patrick.
Oh, it's a pleasure always to have you on, Nick, because I find your work really interesting. I find you really interesting. So let's get started. How many drafts have you played in so far this year, and how many more do you think you'll be in before opening day?
So I think I'm in 6 right now, and guess what? I have Cole Reagans in 4 of them. but I have, I think, one or two left. I know I have my hometown one on Wednesday before opening day. I'm trying to keep them smaller every single year, as I found myself less interested actually in playing the full game of fantasy baseball, and more it's my own internal game of, can I be as accurate as possible ranking starting pitchers every single day? So I just don't have as much time for like the massive leagues I used to.
Yeah, I think a lot of people I talked to, we were both at Tout this weekend, and there was a kind of a shindig on Saturday night. And everybody I talked to seemed to be saying, except for the really young guys, yeah, I seem to be cutting back every year.
Yeah.
I think a lot of guys are replacing the drafts that take work during the season with those gladiator leagues and the
right.
leagues where you draft and literally draft and hold the whole thing. There's no
right.
there's no dropping guys, or there's no moves during the year at any rate. And it's a change that comes with the other responsibilities of adulthood, I think, more than anything. Yeah. It certainly was for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's, just as the site has grown, it started with me just doing, an hour or so in the morning, and maybe two, and that would kind of be it when it comes to the scope of the site. And now it's, all the different elements of content that I do, and then trying to work with the team and everything like that. And it's just a lot more, where I find myself letting my leagues fall to the wayside, not to mention the commitments that you have to have for Sundays when it comes to fab on these weekly leagues is just, it's a lot. And for me personally, in season, Saturday and Sunday are my reset times for the most part, even though I still work on those days. So trying to remove myself from the game is what I try to do is most then. It can be really, really hard.
When did you open the PitcherList site?
It was initially called Pitcher Gifts in 2014. And that was February, I think I want to say like February 10th or so, in 2014. And it got shut down 3 months later by MLB because we were, a gift database. And they said, hey, it's 2014. We don't want gifts anywhere. And I said, are you joking? Like, this is a great thing for you. I'm teaching people about these players so that they can go and be excited about them and actually understand them better. And so I, of course, try to be really smart and be like, oh no, I can just convince them. It's me versus this wonderful corporate entity. I can totally convince them. And obviously not. So I shut it down, and then due to the cease and desist that they sent me, and I returned as PitcherList next year because I just enjoy the writing so much. So this is, I guess, technically my 11th season, but my 10th full season at PitcherList.
I've talked to other people who started off pretty much as you did, with a small site, very personal, doing all the work yourself because it's not that much work to do. But now, as you said, PitcherList has grown pretty substantially over the 10 years. It's now like one of the leading fantasy baseball websites on the web. No, it's true. It's got a great professional, beautiful design. This must take a lot of administrative work, and I'm wondering how much does the administrative side of things cut into the sort of the reason you started it in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that it's part of the fun for me, though. I've always been someone who enjoys the process of creation. I know that sounds so hippy-dippy, and there are a lot of things I said that often sound that way. But I wanted to play guitar forever. That's what I thought I was going to do. And I play guitar to create songs and to do things that hadn't happened before, right? And I love the idea, even just the act of pitching. Like, I have to have a vision of what's going to work well and what isn't, and I get to create a sequence, right? I get to decide, all right, cool, I think this is the one that's going to be effective and good and not, right? And for me, it's been so fun to be able to challenge myself and say, what do I think would be a good product? What do I think would be helpful for others that doesn't exist now, and how can we do this better? And even when it comes to design and the look of it, I mean, we've changed the look of our site so many times, but it's because I constantly iterate and question what is the most effective way of showcasing this stuff that we have. And so I have, I spent a lot of my time talking to some fantastic managers that we have here. I mean, I really can't emphasize this enough. It's something that I learned, I think, in 2019 or so, that I finally, maybe 2018, I said, okay, fine, let's have some managers. As Miles Nelson, our COO and VP, he said, hey, Nick, this is what management looks like. And he sent me one of those, obviously it's a tree chart, like an umbrella, like there's Nick, and then he reports to these people who then report to these people, you know, or so on and so forth. And I was like, yes, Miles, I know how this works, but I just don't want to do it yet. But that was when we had about 30 people, and it was like, okay, I can't be the manager of everyone anymore. And now we have about, I want to say on the PitcherList side, it's about 100 or so. I haven't really kept track of it. But now it's, and also like another 20 or so for the Cubulist side. So yeah, I have a nice balance right now of content versus management. Right now in March, it's much more content focused. It has to be. But then once the season starts, I know the content I have to do every day. And then I have management also. So I'd say in season, it's about 70-30, maybe 50-50. 70-30 being more content side. And then once October, November, December hits, it flips completely, as I'm just trying to plan to make sure everything is all right. But over time, I mean, I talked to Rick Wolf about this. I know it's going to be, you know, it's 80-20 now, you could say, content management. And over time, that it has to flip. And I know that. And I often say, you know, if anyone's listening who is trying to get into this and feels that they can do what I do, then great. I want to meet you because I'm looking for my apprentice because I can't do this forever. And I can teach you the ways so that you can be an efficient starting pitching analyst and do all the fun stuff.
Anything you've seen or heard so far in draft season that has surprised you?
Oh, man. I don't know. It's... Well, I mean, I am surprised that like everyone is doing the full U-turn on Cole Riggins finally. That's wonderful. No, it's honestly nothing really that shocking. I think I am noticing entering the season that I was trying to be aware of early ADP trends affecting March ADP. And that is the original groupthink, despite us changing our views on a lot of guys, they still linger in the form of ADP and subconsciously affect bias in that way. Or they are a bias, right, that affects our draft picks. And there are certain areas where that still is living. And I'm fighting constantly with that, even though I'm like, Nick, you do your thing and you feel this way and it doesn't matter what the ADP says. And it's really, really hard to do. I'd say that's probably the thing I noticed the most. But yeah, nothing really too shocking in my view this year.
There's always been a lot of discussion that the ADPs are kind of a self-reinforcing mechanism.
Right.
Partly because people are just, I better get him now because this is around or whatever, even though I don't agree with the valuation. And partly because there's so many drafts that are done by auto pick in whole or in part because people aren't being super active with drafting their teams after they get their, you know, like Bobby Witt and Marcus Semien in the first two rounds and Luis Castillo in the third. All right, my job's done. Just put it on the robot and let the robot pick, which is going to be done by ADPs, which then comes into the system, reporting into the system as what the ADPs are, which then repeats them and this round and round and round we go, and it's very hard to move in the ADPs. I think that's a real advantage for people who can ignore them or identify where the value, your valuation is sufficiently different from the ADP valuation that there are bargain opportunities and avoid opportunities.
Yeah, it's part of the fun of what I do, I think. Is it's also, I mean, I'm not in any way saying that I'm the correct answer. I'm trying to find it. But it is interesting. I was actually talking about this a little with Eric Samulski, how there's a lot of ADPs that are done, especially early on, with people that are big projection people. And what I find so fun every year is that I don't make my ranks due to projections, which sounds crazy because, like, how can you actually say this guy's better or worse based on no actual hard number expectation? Soft and yeah, number. I do have loose ones in my head. And sometimes I, you know, really need to recalibrate, like, oh, right. Yeah, wait, hold on. Across the board, I am considering this guy a little bit better. But what I actually am more about is grasping what I think their skill set is more likely to be this year based on each of their pitches in their arsenal and how they use them. And then, of course, any other context of, like, you know, park and teams and so on and so forth, to then get an expectation of generally a range of what we should go for. And I think a lot of ADPs, especially on the later side, are very heavily shifted toward the full season expectation. A really good example is I just did Tout Wars that uses CBS points. It's 12th team head-to-head. I did this on Sunday in New York. And that's a league that very heavily favors six innings pitched guys who should be going every single day through the year. So, like, Miles Michaelis and Kyle Gibson are going to actually be positive in this one, right? Does not mean you should be drafting them. It just means that we look at the projections and we have guys that we really like in our draft, say, like Reese Olson. I love him right now. I like him a lot better than Michaelis and Gibson, even in this league, because sure, his projection isn't going to be as high, but when he's in the rotation, the innings expectations are actually somewhat close here and much better production, right? So you see the projection that says, oh, cool, he's in the rotation the entire year, should be 180 innings, 170, while Reese Olson, oh, I don't know, 130 or so. And we follow that projection number that gives us the dollar value, and we just say, well, no, Michaelis is a better dollar value. I'm just going to go for that. And there are a lot of scenarios that that happens inside of drafts where we take the one that's just like, okay, cool, expectation full year, and we just go with that instead of just recognizing, well, wait, hold on. This is a big variance of it. There's a big replacement value on the wire to how this is utilized. And especially in Tout here for me in a 12-teamer, I remember being in this league in 2022, and I had a field day just every week figuring out, you know, my SP, my last two guys on my team would always be essentially someone I picked up for like a dollar or a couple of dollars, because they're always someone that I can confidently feel good about going like five, six innings each week, good matchups, that kind of stuff. So it's a constant battle with me, and it allows me to, you know, put out ranks that are like completely different in some ways, but then somehow actually be similar. Like we match it up really well. And that's what I was talking about with Eric, right? Was, yeah, we still kind of get to the same spot, which is really a fun thing about it.
You're listening to Baseball HQ Radio, Patrick Davitt with Nick Pollock from pitcherlist.com. And Nick, you've started publishing the notes you take during spring training. And before we get to some of the details about some of the pitchers, why did you start adding these notes to the content at Pitcher List?
Yeah, I realized that I had this podcast, the Plus Pitch podcast, that I was normally just doing, I think in 2022, was just for PL Plus members, which is why it was such a good name at the time. It was a plus pitch. It was good for PL Plus members. And then that was just going to be me in the morning just talking about my starting pinching thoughts whenever I felt like it, kind of. And then I like doing it enough. And I, for my own knowledge base, I do the SB Roundup every night. And that's, I think, honestly, if you read one thing that I do, don't read the list. Don't do all the other stuff. Just read the SB Roundup. That's actually, I think, the true valuable thing that I do, is just every single start is covered. And I realized that spring training, I needed to have that knowledge base too. I couldn't really get away anymore with being the person I try to be, not following to a T every single pitching performance data that we get, including spring training. So then I said, fine, I'm going to do this plus pitch podcast. That's how I'm going to do it. I can kind of do my own pace. It's not really like the full encompassing thing like it is SB Roundup in season. So I'm going to do that podcast. And I always would put out this tweet on Twitter about the guys to watch that day on TV. But then everyone would always ask, like, well, where's the update on this? I'm like, well, I don't have time to watch all this stuff. I can't do it. I'm just telling you what to be excited about. But then I started to realize, well, this would be effective too, right? I can, I should be knowing this stuff anyway. And I also do these live streams in the morning. So why not just make this all efficient thing? Like, I make notes anyway for this podcast. Let's just stick it on the site too. And then everyone has this extra piece of information that should be a valuable thing. It's a good thing for me too, to have to write all of it out. So it just kind of came together in that way. And I try and think of every element or every piece of content I put out has to be efficient. It has to be rooted in some other work I've already done. I don't like doing work that requires me to only do it for that. I think Shelley Burstry put out a really good piece or really good thing on Twitter about the feeling of writing these pieces on baseball that just kind of get lost after that. Like, you put a lot of work into this one article, and then after that, it's like, okay, when's the next one? And it feels very exhausting to do that. And I cannot agree more with that. I used to do those with Fangraphs for a bit, and I pulled back on them, and I just said, no, it's not efficient enough for me to do that. And so these new SB roundups that I do in the morning, those articles, that's efficient because I was doing that work anyway. So it just made a lot of sense to do that, and happy I do.
A lot of drafters were getting after Eury Pérez of the Marlins in early part of spring, and you report now in your notes that there's probably some disappointment coming towards them, because if they snagged Pérez as a SP2 or even as an SP1, well, too bad for you. What's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, not fun for Eury Pérez managers right now. I'm personally expecting it to be just full-on shutdown at this point. The way that Craig Mish phrased it was just, oh boy, it sounded really ominous and bad. You know, fingernail issue, but then all of a sudden now pain in the elbow and all of that. And oh my gosh. It is interesting for the Marlins rotation. It's kind of crazy how much depth that they have and how much they needed it. Where it was supposed to be Eury Pérez in here, and honestly, Sandy Alcantara entering this year. And you could say, from if you're talking this time last year, Braxton Garrett and Trevor Rogers and Amber Cabrera. And now Cabrera, Garrett, and Pérez are all gone. Of course, Kennedy too. But you get A.G. Puck, and he's locked in now. It's not even like fighting for a fifth spot. He's locked in, and Ryan Weathers is throwing harder. Is it 96, 97? Or is it actually 95? I don't know yet, but it's gone a little bit down, but that's still kind of exciting. And Trevor Rogers is looking better with his changeup and his slider now. And now maybe we might see Max Meyer, who's good. He's not unreal, but he's good. And that's exciting at the very least. But yeah, if you have Eury Pérez, it's not very fun.
The Twins announced that Wiley veteran Anthony DeSclafani will take the fifth slot in the rotation. And I know that was disappointing news for you.
Oh my gosh, because Louis Varland is so good. I mean, okay, he's not like the greatest thing ever, but he's one of those that when he does get regular starts, it might take like two games or so, but his third start, Louis Varland is going to soar. He's got a really good flat four seamer, which means it's really hard to hit it at the top of the zone. He likes to do that. He throws it 95 plus. He has a really good slider and cutter too underneath it. He's got all the tools. It's just he needs opportunity, and he was going to have it. And then all of a sudden, the Twins made this deal with the Mariners after the Mariners got Anthony DeSclafani. And now, yeah, Varland's just going to have to wait. So Descafani is going to be starting. He just has a slider and he hopes for the best. And it's very frustrating right now, but that's just how it is.
Do you think there's value, especially in a deeper draft, to grab Varland in the 35th round on the expectation that Descafani is maybe not all that the Twins are hoping for?
I mean, I expect Varland to start this year. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I honestly give it like a month. And not to mention, I mean, he's the SP6. So it doesn't even require Descafani necessarily. Maybe something else comes up inside the rotation that Varland will have to show up. And I'm looking forward to his opportunities, not someone else failing, of course.
You had a hunch a little earlier this season that Cody Bradford was going to open the season as the number five starter for the Rangers. What are your expectations of Cody Bradford in that role?
Yeah, I remember actually putting out a tweet being like, the Rangers aren't actually going to do that, right? And then they just kind of have. Jose Urania, believe it or not, is the SP6 in my view right now, which is hilarious. But Eno Saris actually listed him as a deep league sleeper, Cody Bradford. And to be honest, I mean, you're pitching for the Rangers. That's a pretty decent scenario that will at least give you win opportunities. Cody Bradford isn't terrible. He's a lefty with a surprisingly decent four-seamer shape. It's very boring. And there's a lot of ways this goes terribly. I would not call myself excited to draft Cody Bradford anywhere. And I like to think that there are more sneaky options you can find. But, you could do worse than playing matchups with Cody Bradford.
You commented on the possibility that Blake Snell might sign in Houston. I don't know how late that opinion was cast, but what are the odds and where else do you see him as possibly signing?
Right. So we got news on Sunday that they were in serious pursuit, and now Bob Nightingale is saying that no, Blake Snell is likely not going to be with the Astros, but it makes all the sense in the world for him to be at the Giants. I don't know. The Giants need it terribly. They need both him and Montgomery. The Rangers make sense too. Someone's got to just do it at this point.
How about the
I
Yankees?
Really hope it's not the Yankees. It doesn't make sense to the Yankees unless they defer the deal. They have to pay essentially double this year because they're over the luxury tax threshold at this point. So I'm not really sure what the plan is with Snell. I also want to think that I wasn't even in on Snell before. And now he has to be delayed a little bit. I know that he's clearly pitching right now. He's not just like twiddling his thumbs and streaming or something like that. But he's not game ready yet. And same with Montgomery. Like, you need to get some time against actual players before actually starting. So it's not looking great going after Snell. And then, of course, there's a whole thing about how pristine his command was last year to play the game of avoiding the middle of the plate and not giving into batters. That is so hard to replicate over a long period of time. That has me out on Snell anyway.
At the bottom of the spring training notebook, there's an updated list of the rotations, and it's color-coded. Guys in green are pretty much locks, and then the yellow guys are on the fence, and the red guys, I presume, means they're really on the bubble, and if anything else comes along that's better, they're probably going to lose the spot. I noticed right away Baltimore has a rotation, of course, Burns, Grayson Rodriguez, and then Dean Kramer, Tyler Wells, and Cole Irvin. And a lot of people like these guys in drafts. I was noticing at Towers on the weekend. But Kramer, Wells, and Irvin, even though they've been really popular in those mid and later rounds, underneath the Baltimore line, you wrote that it's conditional on there not being an implosion by Kramer, Wells, or Irvin. First of all, how likely is an implosion by one or more of those guys?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think at this point that they're going to. They haven't. Unless, like, Dean Kramer is just like, nope, I can't do this. Then he's got it. Same with Cole Irvin, really, at this point. Because the backups are Cade Povich and Chase McDermott and really Justin Armbruster, too. Those are three prospect pitchers that you should be aware of for the Orioles this year. They've also hinted that Armbruster would be the first option in season, but I really don't think any of them are going to hint at this. Then there's Julio Teheran, who threw like four innings of ball yesterday. That is what? it was good, I guess, yeah. But no. Albert Suarez was someone interesting for a moment, and he looked really good in his first appearance this spring, then a little bit worse, and then much worse, and that's not going to be a thing in all likelihood. So, no, those are the guys, and what's so good about it, honestly, I don't touch Dean Kramer. I go after Tyler Wells, who's looking good. They have a fantastic opening schedule, the Orioles do, and I love going after them at the end of drafts because you can steal a win or two against these poor opponents. We're talking like the Pirates and the Angels. Like you want to do that. So I'm very curious about chasing Tyler Wells in the end of my drafts. Dean Kramer's not as exciting to me and doesn't have as good command as Tyler Wells to me. So Cole Irvin hasn't looked as good, but I still think he's at a good enough place to bring value as well.
In the Angels rotation, you write that Jose Soriano could be a thing, but that he'd have to bounce Chase Silseth, which isn't real likely. So what's the status here? Why could Jose Soriano be a thing, and why can't he bounce Chase Silseth?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a pretty locked rotation spot. Ron Washington was like, oh, yeah, no, we're considering Jose Soriano as a starter. We go, what? Who? Why? How? And he's been starting. He started yesterday. It seemed okay. I need to really see more data on this. One of the most unfortunate things about spring training is that not all of these parks have public Statcast data, and also they have what I call the belly cam a lot, which is as if you're on your belly in shallow left center field looking at the game, and it's terrible. I can't like do any proper visual scouting because I can't see, you know, their pitches effectively or how their stuff is moving. So Jose Soriano, I haven't really gotten a ton of good information on. However, last year he was throwing mid to upper 90s and decent four-seamer shape with a good curveball. So there is some life there, but really what the scenario is that he's the SP6 for the Angels. He's someone that they want stretched out. Then when there is an opportunity, it's likely that Soriano will jump in. I don't really think you need to be very into it. The Angels as a whole is not a rotation that I am excited about in the slightest, not even Griffin Canning. I'm so sorry. I just think his pitches are too hittable, and it's a bad situation for Canning in that way. Soriano, it's interesting, but it's not really going to be a thing, sadly.
The Pirates rotation still looks like a work in progress of sorts. They've got Mitch Keller, they've got Martin Perez and Marco Gonzalez in those first three slots, but I'm just looking at the names that have appeared somewhere on pitcher list or in your various video and audio presentations. Luis Ortiz, Aranzi Contreras, Bailey Falter, Jared Jones, Eric Lauer, Chase Anderson, and for some reason, the Pirates have just signed Domingo Herman. So that's, by my count, 42 or 43 guys for two spots. So how is that all going to work out?
You know, it's so funny. I actually went through that list again today in the article thing I just published, and I forgot Anderson even, and I still had like seven guys, right? Quinn Priester was in there too.
Quinn Priester, I didn't mention. You're right.
Right. Oh my gosh. So it's frustrating because you have the two most Pirates signings ever in Martin Perez and Marco Gonzalez. And you have Mitch Keller, who for some reason decided to sign an extension to instead of trading away, which is just, are you serious? Mitch Keller should have been traded away and some other team would hopefully unlock him. But fine, you have those three. The four and five has been up for grabs, really. It seems like the Pirates are going after Luis L. Ortiz. And in his last outing, it was actually the most exciting outing I've seen from Ortiz in a bit, because he actually spotted his sinker arm side effectively. He actually got a changeup involved that was good and his slider was good. And this is like, oh, hey, that actually could work as a starter, except I don't believe that you have this command for any sort of reasonable amount of time. The number five spot is what's so weird. And Jared Jones is an elite starter. This four-seamer is upper 90s. His stuff is insane on it. The induced vertical break is great. He gets it upstairs. It's so hard to hit. The slider slash cutter is filthy as well, and he pairs it perfectly. His closest comp, in my view, is exactly what I saw really in spring of 2022 before Spencer Strider. I think that was 2022, if not 2021. And it's filthy. It's great. Is he going to start? And I have no idea, because the Pirates initially weren't even putting him to start games. It was just putting him in relief. Now they finally have, and he went four innings yesterday and four Ks, one walk, and maybe one earned run, maybe zero, but like, yeah, this is great. But then there are all those other guys, and it doesn't make sense really for the Pirates to start Jared Jones now. They should have him in the minors, because why would they possibly need to put him in now? They're going to limit him. You don't want to start the arbitration clock. You would love to have him pass the Super 2. Why would you do it and just throw in Contreras and Falter and whoever? I hate that they have Herman. I hate that any team signed Herman. So if I'm a betting man, I'm going to say no. But I would say the ceiling of Jared Jones is too good to pass up. And you will know if you are rostering Jared Jones or not before the season starts. And this is the thing that I really harp on, is making sure that the last round picks you have not only are guys that you want to start the opening weeks. Like, you should not be drafting someone, you know, last round of your draft who you're not even starting the first week, because you're going to want to flip him before he even does anything for your team. Make sure it's actually something that could be production for you. But the second is someone that you actually can make a decision on, because the first couple of weeks of the season are the most valuable waiver wire ads of the year. These are guys that can make an impact for the longest amount of time, and you will not get another shot at. Obviously, there are always very valuable waiver ads in season and so on, but the clarity comes when guys are doing something brand new, have new skills that we didn't know about, and bam, there it is. So what's great about Jared Jones is you will know if he's worthwhile to actually roster on your team or not. And yeah, then you can just cut him and get somebody else. So I'm a big fan of that, but boy, is it a messy situation.
And as I understand it, if they get past the Super 2 deadline and he's still in the minors, they really have an incentive not to bring him up before September, because then he keeps his Rookie of the Year eligibility for next year. And if he happens to win Rookie of the Year, they get that extra pick. And so there's a disincentive to bring him up after that arbitration date, for sure. You're listening to Baseball HQ Radio, Patrick Davitt, with Nick Pollock from Pitcher List. And Nick, I always like to wrap up these discussions by looking at some boons and banes in honor of PitcherList.com and your encyclopedic knowledge of the pitching situation. We'll just look at pitchers. So who's a pitcher who's going in the early round who you think could be a boon?
I'll go with Pablo Lopez. I just think that you see a 115 whip, it scares a lot of people, but I think he has such a full arsenal and really good command across the board. He had the third highest swing strike rate on four seamers last year. He also was tied for third in strikeouts, believe it or not, with Kevin Gausman. Great team contacts, just constantly gets better. Lots of weapons. I'm just a huge fan of Pablo Lopez, and I'm glad to see that. I mean, I think he's gone higher up in drafts, but there are times that he falls to the end of the third or in the fourth round, and I just think that's so, so good.
How about a pitcher in the mid rounds you think could be a boon?
I mean, obviously, I'm a huge fan of Cole Reagans, but to give it something a little different, I'll go with Bobby Miller. I think Miller's arsenal is absurd. Throws 99 miles per hour on his four seamer with ridiculous movement upstairs and good enough flat fastballs. And he's starting to maybe go upstairs with them more. And he just needs something else in his secondary to be a true whiff pitch. But everything he does is just filthy. So I think it's just a matter of time in a perfect team context. And I'm grabbing him and Joe Musgrove as well in a great situation, who's getting undervalued too as a every 5 days, six innings guy. So those are the ones I found a lot in my drafts.
It's assuming that Joe Musgrove doesn't drop an anvil on his toe or something in the meantime.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good bet. So
you do it once, shame on you. I'm curious about the idea that Los Angeles is a really good team context. And I know we think of them as a powerhouse team, so there's probably a lot more access to wins. But I wonder what you think of the reputation, pretty much earned, that the Dodgers mess around with their rotation during the year, and they'll, you know, let a guy skip a start or put him on the IL so he misses two starts. They've got pitchers coming back from the IL, so if there's a little bit of playing time risk, is there any kind of team context risk to a team like the Dodgers that messes around with their pitching so much?
Great question. I think it's really more focused on, hey, how many innings is Bobby Miller actually going to get, right? The defense is great. The offense is great. So you have wins, and that's a good thing. Bobby Miller is also a pitcher that the Dodgers have showcased. Yeah, he can go six innings. He's fine. He can do that. He's also a quicker out guy than others. Like, he throws a fair number of strikes and gets balls in play at a good rate that you want, which then means that he can be more efficient than others to get those six innings. So when it comes to the Dodgers, about, yeah, I used to call it Dodgeritis, where we used to be guys on the IL, or they wouldn't get to be stretched out properly. The thing is, Eno loves to say that, hey, last year the innings leader for the Dodgers was Clayton Kershaw at 130. And I think that should show you that there's a lot of volatility in the arms here. The one pitcher that I think is most, or is best equipped to go 170 plus innings, is Bobby Miller. And they set him up last year to be that workhorse in 2024. Now, he's not going to be starting the first two games in San Diego, but that's because Yamamoto is going to be able to get the full rest, and it's Glasnow. We totally get that. We also know that Glasnow has his injury history. We also know that Yamamoto is going to need a little bit more rest as the season goes on. And I think the Dodgers, you know, as things happen inside this rotation, they're going to continue to lean on Bobby Miller consistently every 5 days as much as they can. So he might be the one that actually is fine and everyone else kind of sifts through. I'm not too concerned about that with Bobby Miller. And I think the benefits of the win potential and the team context of the defense and offense really make him, and a good bullpen too, make him benefit more than get hurt by that Dodgeritis.
And who's a pitcher going in the later rounds who could be a boon?
Oh, there's so many. I think the ones that get overlooked a little bit are the guys in the Red Sox, like Whitlock and Tanner Houck, who are positioned. I mean, the way I think about innings is just, are you going every 5 days? And is this a team that will let you go six innings? Like, can you do that? And those guys can do it now, which is great. There's also Reynaldo Lopez, who's in such a good situation now with Atlanta, and he has that SP5 spot, and he gets the White Sox first, and I'm finding myself every league I can getting him at the end of drafts as well. And again, it's all about a guy like you want to start early. So even if you might be intrigued by JP France, like, you get some bad starts in the beginning of the year and you don't want to do that. It's just not the context you want. The last one I'll mention is someone I'm just paying attention to for the next week or two, because if Luis Gil gets that SP5 spot for the Yankees, he is so good. Four-seamer is absolutely elite when it comes to how flat it is and how fast it is and all the stuff you want. That four-seamer has it. And now he's added a changeup to pair with the slider to get strikes in the zone. Oh my gosh, is that good. So I'm a huge fan of that. I don't know if he will, but I'm starting to take a spec ad on Luis Gil, just like Jared Jones, where if he is starting, that's a big impact for your team. And if he's not, then you can move on to something else.
Over to the Baines. Who's an early round pitcher you don't like at his current ADP as a poor value?
Yeah, I don't really go for Zach Gallen right now because I'm terrified after 240 innings last year, including the playoffs, that he's not going to be able to handle that for a full year. And you throw in the fact that I don't really think his arsenal is filled with elite stuff. It's much more command and context situation. We have a new strike called new stat called strike minus ICR rate that it doesn't love. So I'm just saying, do you throw lots of strikes? And if you do, is it beneficial contact for you? And Gallen kind of gets away with a little bit too reliant on the defense that I think should be a little bit worse. I even threw that into stud rate, which is another addition to that, which throws in swing strikes, which is strikes that utterly dominate. And yet even Zach Gallen doesn't even have the highest swing strike rate. So he even falls further on that one, which is fascinating to me. And I feel like that is much more of a precarious early round starter than we like to think he is.
A lot of cool anagrams at your site.
It starts with the anagram, right? They just got to figure out what's that.
Yeah. They're really fun. Who's a mid-round pitcher you think might be a bane?
Oh, man. Mid-round guy that I'm seeing a lot that I think is going to be a bane. I don't know what to make of of Carlos Rodon right now. I think that a lot of people are expecting more from it and turning down arms who actually I think could make impacts on your team. And same one is Bryce Miller. There's a lot of assumption with him, actually, and Logan Gilbert too, that they're both going to take steps forward this year. But what I've said constantly is I feel command is the market inefficiency. And it is a lot easier to identify who has good command and who doesn't just by watching the game, just seeing, hey, are you getting your strikeouts on pitches that you actually wanted to execute in the right locations? Are you throwing the strikes that you want to do? Are you navigating an at-bat by setting them up by over here, over there? And even when it's a ball, is it close or is it well away? And Bryce Miller and Logan Gilbert are not good command guys, but Brian Wu is. And that makes me so much more inclined to go after, say, Brian Wu than both of those guys. While Rodon, I just think it's way too reliant on the velocity. And we haven't seen it yet. And it just, it's too much wish casting to turn down other guys instead.
A lot of injury risk, too, after the past
few years.
Well, yeah,
there's
that,
too. I mean, absolutely.
On top of everything else. And finally, who's a late-round pitcher, Bane? Just a sleeper that you've been hearing about that you wouldn't touch, even at the low ADP?
I'm seeing, Reed Detmers go, which is hilarious, because I used to be the biggest Reed Detmers guy, but then I learned about fastball shape and realized that he does not have a good one. He has a really bad one. And kind of actually with Jesus Lizardo, I didn't mention as a mid-round Bane for me, really bad four-seamer. And he needs to, both of them need to be pristine with it for it to work. So I'm not in there. I'm trying to think of other ones that I've seen people go for. Patrick Sandoval I've seen. I just don't want to touch that whatsoever. So all the Angels, absolutely not. But yeah, John Gray I've seen go, and I feel like John Gray is just one trick pony with his slider. And there just isn't enough to chase. Chris Paddock isn't showcasing anything that interesting with his stuff to showcase being a different pitcher. And I'm okay with it being the last round pick, but not really the thing that I want to go for there. I'm sure there's 20 million other ones. I'm just, for whatever reason, I just blanked on all of them right now. But yeah, those are the guys. Oh, I'll throw in Nick Lodolo or any sort of the Reds guys, because that's just too rough of a team context. And Andrew Abbott, I see go. And I say he does not have good command in a park where you have to have great command. So I don't want to touch him whatsoever.
Nick Pollock's boons are Pablo Lopez of Minnesota, Bobby Miller of the Dodgers, Joe Musgrove of San Diego, Garrett Whitlock and Tanner Houck of Boston, Ronaldo Lopez in Atlanta, Luis Gil in the Yankees, his Baines, Zach Gallen of Arizona, Carlos Rodon of the Yankees, Bryce Miller and Logan Gilbert of Seattle, couple of Angels, Reed Detmers, Patrick Sandoval, Chris Paddock in Minnesota. Chris Paddock's been going earlier and earlier in my drafts.
Yeah.
And in Cincinnati, Nick Lodolo and Andrew Abbott. Nick, this has been great. Remind our listeners all the different places where they can keep up with your work.
Oh, just come to pitcherlist.com. Just hang out. Just read all our stuff and tell me how you feel about it. I live stream every morning, playback.tv/pitcherlist. Come hang out. If you disagree with stuff with me, I think that's awesome, because I think it's such a fun conversation. And anyone who has watched that stream, especially as I do my top 100 list, will tell you that if you bring up a point and I don't have good rhetoric against it, then I will adjust my rankings, because I don't care about what I put before. I just want to be right. So please help me be right. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that you could take the time today, Nick. I know you're busier than a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. But whatever it is, you're a real busy guy, and I appreciate you taking a few minutes out of your busy, busy schedule to help us out. I do appreciate it. I hope I get to talk to you again during the year.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's an honor being here. Thank you so much, Patrick. This was fun.
Nick Pollock writes, live streams, and podcasts at pitcherlist.com, but he doesn't fill out the payroll forms. Coming up, we have our feature expert interview with Ed DiCaria, research head at baseballhq.com. But first, let me highlight the resources available to you when you subscribe to baseballhq.com, the best fantasy baseball website in the business. Our scouting team has comprehensive coverage of the prospects who can make or break a fantasy season. We have player performance validation in facts and flukes. We have news updates in playing time today, and we have roster forecasting in playing time tomorrow. This week, it's time to go to the Central, with Daniel Marcus looking at the five teams in the National League Central, including right-handed starter Jared Jones vying for a spot in the Pittsburgh rotation. Nick Pollock talked about that. And Cubs third baseman Michael Busch transitioning to first base this spring. And Brian Rudd looks at the five teams in the American League Central, including the Kansas City bullpen and some infield maneuvering in Detroit. We have buyer's guides for hitters, starters, and relievers. This week, columnist Stephen Nickrand has end gamers for starting pitchers and hitters, and bullpen columnist Doug Dennis has relievers who cost $1 or less. We have fantasy market analysis in the Market Pulse, long shot suggestions in the Speculator column, player injury analysis with team injury reports, and the Big Hurt column. This week, analyst Matt Cederholm looks at some of the early injuries in spring training that have fantasy managers on the edges of their seats. There's gaming strategy analysis for Roto, points leagues, NFBC, and alternative formats, and groundbreaking fantasy baseball research. As well, we have tools like the player projections updated every day, updated depth charts, daily dashboards, pitcher matchups planners, bullpen indicators, batter consistency reports, complete pitcher PQS logs. We'll be talking with Ed DiCaria about that. Potential surgers and faders and other leading indicators for hitters and pitchers. Add it all up. You get expert content plus tools that you can use to improve your teams and win your leagues. And they're why we call our site the best fantasy baseball website in the business.
Baseball HQ Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Baseball HQ Radio. I'm Patrick Davitt. Time now for our second feature expert interview of this Friday full edition with Ed DiCaria, the Director of Research at BaseballHQ.com. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thanks, BD. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Just coming off Tout Wars weekend, so a little frazzled with catching up with mundanery and some other baseball stuff and getting the garbage out and that kind of stuff. So it'll all be a little better later in the week. Plus, I've got a couple of HQ radios to produce this week on top of everything else, and I'm running a slow draft, which is in round 40 of 42. Thank goodness, it'll soon be over. I'm now down to the point where I'm pretty much just putting it on auto draft and putting a list of 12 guys in that I can live with, and move along. So
auto draft scares the hell out of me, PD. I don't think I've ever clicked an auto draft.
Oh no,
no.
I don't normally use it in an ordinary like 23+7 kind of thing. I would never do it, mm-hmm. But in this format, because it's best ball and points. I basically just use the projections, calculate the points, stack rank them from top to bottom, and pretty much draft in that order with a few diversions to make sure I get a catcher at a certain point, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it makes sense. I could see it in the reserve rounds, but yeah, anything earlier, I don't ever feel comfortable just in case something changed.
The other part of this particular draft, it's the Raz Slam points draft, as I mentioned. And I was in the Dominican Republic for a week during it, and the Wi-Fi is a little bit spotty at the place we were staying, and sometimes they turn it off, or you're out on the beach and you're out of range, these kind of things. And in those drafts, which are on the NFBC platform, you've got 4 hours, and if you don't have a queue that you made, they'll just give you the top guy on the queue that they made.
Which is
something you really want to avoid, because that queue's essentially based on ADP.
About the queue.
Just make your own queue for sure. They have a way that you can make your list and then save it as a CSV or a tab separated file, and then you can upload it and it'll appear in there. So that works. That's fantastic when you can do that. Yeah. So how many drafts, speaking of which, are you playing this year, and how many have been completed and how many are to come?
Yeah, I keep it simple. Well, I would like to probably do a little bit more, but just two. So I'm really just doing TGFBI, and then I've got a really fun, longstanding home league that I've been in. So TGFBI is complete. We actually had one of the faster slow drafts, and then always a struggle to figure out the draft date for the home league. So that's actually going to be April 5th. So
after opening day,
which is always odd, but sometimes that's all you can do when you're trying to get a bunch of people, a bunch of 40 somethings together that got all their own priorities and whatnot. So
yeah, So a post-opening day draft, there's already some questions and kerfuffles about the Seoul games in Korea. Do they stat? Do the stats count? You know, all these kind of things. I think they have to, but that's just my opinion. So you are getting your stats right back to Seoul, even though you're April 5th.
Yep. And that's happened before over the course of our league. And I think a lot of leagues do that. I think it's fine. It's just more information, right? If people want to spend an extra buck on the person that hit two home runs on the opening day or three in the opening week, whatever, like there's a cost to that.
Yeah.
Last year we drafted after opening day as well. And I remember just end game relievers. Like there was just relievers that had like 10 strikeouts and a win, or like, you know, eight strikeouts and a save or something like that. And you can get them for a buck, because there was enough of them where those owners that were paying attention to that could take advantage of that. You take the guy, you drop him a week later and pick up someone else you might like better. So it's just, but everyone knows the information. So it's fair.
Yeah, it is fair. And that's, I think the key thing is that nobody's taking advantage of something that they know that everybody else doesn't, which used to be a real big thing in drafting back when information was not quite so easy to acquire. When you were talking about getting a guy who had one win and, you know, a bunch of strikeouts as a relief pitcher, I think sometimes that's not just a flash in the pan. I think that can be a real good indicator that this guy might be in that leverage situation often enough during the year that he's, you know, he might be worth upgrading from wherever you had him a little higher, because if they're using him in games in that leverage situation, there's a chance that he keeps getting those kind of slots and might be worth hanging on to for a buck.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Obviously it depends on the format, and the format I'm talking about is great. Like we actually force five relievers. So there's plenty of interesting speculations on relievers. It's a really interesting way to play, but absolutely. There's so much opportunity with early reliever, insights. You just never know who's going to pop out of nowhere in a given season. I remember hearing one of your episodes recently where you're talking about that very topic.
Yeah. And do you use standard categories in this league?
Standard categories? Yes. Very non-standard format in terms of roster positions and things like that. And at one point we did the scoring was like a little strange for like closers, for example. You would have like a designated save man and then four like other relievers, and the designated save man, you got full credit for their saves, and all the other relievers, you got half credit for their saves. So just a kind of a bizarre set of rules. And for starters, you get six starts per week. You don't get, so there was no concept of like two start weeks and things like that. If you wanted their first start or their second start, you could be much more deliberate about it, trying to a little bit more mimic kind of like real baseball, nothing like a sim league or anything like that, but
yeah,
still pretty interesting.
How long has this league been going?
gotta be 30 years, 25, let's just say 25.
Yeah, that's a good long time. And has it been largely the same group of guys?
Yes, same core. It's fluctuated up and down as, you know, people have kind of moved away from the group a bit. It's actually like two or three kind of core groups that have kind of formed over time. But yeah, pretty much the same core 13. We fluctuated as high as 18, I think, at one point. So now we're kind of down in the valley a little bit again. So it's definitely changed over time. But yeah, pretty interesting. But it's like a call it hybrid keeper dynasty league. Get like 48 contract years to spread over 24 players.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, yeah, it's an interesting format.
And do you draft in person or are you online now?
Now online. And that's, in fact, we moved away from kind of like true hardcore, like we're running our own league our own way. We migrated over to Fantrax a couple of years back just because it was getting too difficult for people to even understand like who's available, who's not. So we had to give up a little bit of our uniqueness in the process of moving. Now, Fantrax is great and you are able to customize a lot, but even Fantrax couldn't handle some of the idiosyncrasies of this league. But yeah, now all online auctions, yeah.
So you're now the director of research at baseballhq.com. How long have you been in that role?
I think it's been about 10 years now, 2015, I believe.
Okay, so in that time, you've figured out a lot of things, I imagine. But in the more general sense, Ed, what do you think makes for good fantasy baseball research?
Well, I think first and foremost, it has to be fantasy relevant, right? I mean, I think there's all sorts of research that can be done, but if it's not kind of meeting the core goal of helping someone, doesn't have to necessarily help them win their league, but I think it has to help them understand their league, help them kind of understand the player pool, something. So I think fantasy relevance is pretty big. I've never been one to, you know, try to eke out that extra, percentage point of root mean square error, or try to get that much, you know, tighter correlation. I mean, obviously those things have a place in the world. But really it's just about like, what's a problem that people are struggling with in real world fantasy, and how do you work backwards from that to say, is there a creative way to kind of solve that? So I think, yeah, just applying fantasy relevance with a sprinkle of creativity, and yeah, you need some math chops. But yeah, that's where my mind goes whenever I think of new topics.
Speaking of math chops, in your real non-fantasy, I'm confused about what's real and what's fantasy after that fantasy normal business. But in your real life, what's your background in doing this kind of research, or what's your background that helps you do this kind of research?
Yeah, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. I feel like I can attribute, strangely, a lot of my career success to my fantasy baseball success, and maybe a little vice versa as well. But I mean, I've been doing fantasy baseball for so long, it kind of got me into like really using Excel and, you know, database work, and that kind of helped me in my work career. So now in my work, I did a lot of consulting and data analytics and things like that as a career, kind of moved into the software product management space like 15 plus years ago. So I've been focused more on that, but always, always, always has been grounded in data analytics, databases, some spreadsheet stuff, whatnot.
I'm old enough that I actually started on Lotus 1-2-3 and migrated to Excel when it basically crowded everybody else out of the market for.
Yeah. I kind of came of age right with Excel. So I was an early Excel user.
Yeah, I remember, I think my first Excel version was the one that was with, Windows version 3 or something like
3.1
that.
3.1 or something
3.1,
like that.
3.1, yeah.
That sounds about right.
and I had the same experience as you, at least. I've never worked in a math-oriented job, but in jobs where I have worked, I've used my Excel skills, which were entirely developed by fantasy baseball noodling.
That's right.
And at one job, I used it to create a schedule to show a common schedule that we could all share show what everybody was doing. And my bosses just thought, man, this is the cat's pajamas. And they started like asking me to do Excel related work, usually not numerical. It was usually taking advantage of, you know, time and schedule and stuff like that.
Right.
So you mentioned a little math. And when I look at a lot of baseball research in the non-fantasy community, I find it's often full of math at such a high level that it starts to verge on abstraction. And I'm wondering, Ed, how do you calibrate the amount of sort of higher level math that is appropriate for a more general audience at a fantasy baseball site like Baseball HQ?
I think largely the math should be kept in the background. There was a great Baseball Prospectus writer. I'm not going to say the name because I might get the wrong name. But he basically used to have a section that said like gory math details to follow and then kind of skip ahead. And I like that approach because it's like, if you want to read this, you go ahead and read it, but otherwise you skip it. I mean, my approach to writing and editing is to try to minimize that. And it's not really specifically just, you know, thinking about the Baseball HQ audience. It's more like what I would prefer. I think that largely, you know, you can kind of go down rabbit holes of writing just about your stats that I don't think is that relevant. I don't know that people need all the math. It's nice to prove it, that it works, that your thing is well thought through. And I think to the degree that you have something that is kind of controversial enough that it needs to be defended, I think, sure, show the math. But otherwise, I think you can kind of like hint at how the math was done, like mention how your model works or something, and then move on to like, why does it matter?
Yeah, for a while, I used to do a lot of research for Baseball HQ, mostly before I got married and started having kids to raise and stuff like that. But my template was I was going to explain the process that was used at a level that I thought was comfortable for me to understand and that I would like that. And I've always presumed that Baseball HQ subscribers have at least some interest and some capabilities in the area of, if I say, you know, as you do in one of the research articles we're going to talk about in a second, but you lay out, here's the first metric, which becomes the basis for the second one, and those two combined become the basis for the third one. And it all makes perfect sense when it's explained that way, but you have to be pretty careful because you want people not to just be dazzled by your math acumen, but be able to understand your math acumen, because I think that makes the case that this is something that's probably accurate and actionable.
Yeah, I think I would much rather leave out the math and just like add the narrative just to help people like come around to understanding the point of view, both the why it's important and how you kind of logically go from one thing to the next. I love when, whether it's mine or someone else's, like research reads more as like an interesting little story with some tidbits sprinkled in here and there. I don't really like the heavy, dense math pieces. And again, unless they put it into a subsection that I can skip and maybe read again later if I want to.
Yeah, I think that's the approach that really works. I still read Baseball Prospectus. That stuff is sometimes pretty advanced, and there are other sites where it's like the Sabre site and those kind of things, which are really advanced. And frankly, a lot of them are just over my head, and that's fine, you know, because I don't expect them to, you know, everybody in the world of fantasy baseball to aim at me or people like me. So I'll take it and try to understand it. And I appreciate it, even if I don't understand it, if I understand that at the end it says, and here's how this works, you know, for you in fantasy baseball. But Prospectus and a lot of those other sites aren't fantasy baseball sites, so they don't feel that compulsion.
Yeah, that's right. And I think even just to keep it in a broader perspective, like the actual research pieces alone, just the fact that there is research is sometimes like just an extra thing that a lot of fantasy managers don't really care about. Just like, okay, sure, you have your research. Tell me when that gets factored into your tools and all your other analyst work and things like that. I'll just like consume it as a byproduct of your research. So the research itself is not interesting to probably a large subset of fantasy managers, much less the math that went into the research. So.
Have you found over the years, because I remember this happening to me, that if you look at an article that's really advanced and it doesn't mention fantasy baseball, do you think to yourself, I think I'd like to use this and do some research that will apply to fantasy baseball, and then I'll publish it at Baseball HQ, which is a fantasy baseball site, and I think that's fair game, as long as you give credit to the original research and say, you know, such and such said at the Sabre site or such and such said at Baseball Prospectus that the following things are true. And if that's the case, then we need to rethink relief pitching, or we need to rethink starting pitching metrics, as often happens, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's broadly stated, that's a really good source of fantasy baseball research topic ideas are like, what are other smart people talking about in the concept and the context of real baseball?
Right.
And then how does that thing apply to our world?
Yep, I agree. You're listening to Baseball HQ Radio, Patrick Davitt with Ed DeCaria from Baseball HQ, the director of research there. And boy, talking about real baseball and fantasy baseball intersection, one of the things Baseball HQ long time ago figured out that what we needed was a fairly simple way to grade starting pitchers as fantasy pitchers. And they came up with this idea of the pure quality start, in which you could scan a box score and figure out really quickly, because it was based on X number of innings, you get a point. Not so many hits, you get a point. So many strikeouts, you get a point, and so forth. But over time, because the pitching environment changes, then the values of those various variables also changes. And there's been a few updates over the years. I think you did one, as a matter of fact, a few years ago. And
that's right.
Before this season, John Enriquez took a look at it and he said, needs to be updated again. What's the goal of doing the pure quality start metric again?
Well, let's go back to when I redid it, because that is when we did, I think we called it the Extreme Makeover Edition back then. Because back then, the issue was there were just way too many quote unquote dominant starts. So the effort then was to rebalance it. So that's where we made a kind of strategic decision to make the PQS outcomes more of a normal distribution, where there is, you know, a smaller number of zeros and ones, which are very bad, you know, more meaty section of twos and threes, which are okay or decent, as we called them, and then a few fours and fives, which are the best or the dominant starts. So to do that, we kind of broke down each of the metrics of PQS. We wanted to keep those, like the framework, the same, but we just basically changed the very binary kind of cutoff points, which is one of the tricks of working with PQS, is you have to call either something is very good for at the component level, it's either very good or terrible. And then the idea is like, okay, you look at that over five metrics, and then you see if someone was really good or terrible. There's like always that fine line of the ones right in the middle. You're like, all it took is one more out or one less this. And it's like, what goes from a zero to a five, and that can happen. So the controversial-ish changes at the time were done in such a way that a lot of pitchers would go from 60% dominant and 20% disastrous to all of a sudden it's like 30-30 or even 30-40. So the issue at the time was, it kind of makes it way too hard to get a dominant start. Now, in my case that I pitched to everyone at the time was that's okay. That's a good thing. Like, it should be a big deal when a pitcher gets a dominant start. It shouldn't just be like every terrible middling starter has a 50% domination rate. It's just not true. So anyways, the issue was when we published that, it was right before, it was almost hilarious, as John pointed out. Over time, like as soon as that redo of PQS came to be, the general league-wide innings pitched per start for starters just started to fall. So if our goal was to give half of starts the PQS point for innings, and half of starters not the PQS point for innings, basically from the date that we did our relaunch, it just started to drop off the map, such that it went from about 50-50. And even then we had to make a tough call because there was no really good midpoint. It was like six innings or like over six innings. And in hindsight, you know, I guessed wrong, basically. I had a guess right, we would have been okay. So John correctly identified that this was a problem. And once we basically tweaked that metric back, everything kind of snaps back to a little bit more normal. So it was good insight by John, a good piece to kind of update it. But it was largely a tweak this time around. We did look at all the other metrics at the same time to make sure nothing else had gone out of whack. But it was basically just the innings pitched component. And once that is now fixed, everything else it's pretty much back to normal. So PQS is a nice, good barometer, still able to kind of understand a pitcher's performance just by reading the box score, which is nice. You don't have to dig into anything else. No complex analytics. It's like, you can just read it. You're like, that was a PQS 4. That's nice. That's a PQS 5. Amazing.
Yeah. I've always thought that the more abstract, even fantasy baseball research that's coming out these days, because people have access to more data, more granular data, and they try to fit it into a fantasy baseball relevant framework, as you said, and then they come up with some answer. But sometimes I find that the answer that comes out is kind of not actionable in a way I'd like it to be. And PQS is the opposite. It's very basic. It's entirely based on what actually happened on the field. And a few years ago, I did a research project that just looked at grading the outcomes on the basis of hard hit, medium hit for pitchers, how many hard hit balls, not as a percentage, just how many were given up, and those kinds of things. And you can add them up and say, this pitcher has a 80% positive, 20% negative, so a 60% total, and go from there. And it kind of worked, but it started to get skewed just like PQS did because of the change in the environment, especially the decline in innings. But I have a question about John's desire to put the PQS scores back into a normal distribution because it had skewed rightward with the whole thing moving more towards better pitching scores or better outcomes and fewer disasters, as we say. And they and you mentioned moving the curve back so it's the median's more or less right in the middle at 2.5 or whatever it is, or 3 actually, I suppose, with the zeros in there, and having a relatively equal fall off to the a tail to the left and a tail to the right. I wonder if, and I don't know what it looks like now, but I wonder if it would be better if it was still slightly skewed to the right, because there are still more dominant starts than disastrous starts, and I think that's okay, and I don't think we need to really work hard on revaluing the whole system so that it's a relatively perfect bell curve. I think the skew should be to the right at least a little bit. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I in general, I think it would be okay if it skewed generally to the right, especially because the fantasy baseball kind of distribution is already to the right. We're largely avoiding obvious disaster starts anyways. Again, it comes back to the components, though. It's really tricky to like get your overall skew how you want it. So that's why, again, when I redid it back in 2015 or whatever, the goal was let's just make each component try to split it and let everything else kind of fall where it may. I think trying to over architect it can just cause other skews later. And this way there's just a clear point of view. The idea is everything kind of splits, every component splits the middle, and wherever things fall, they fall. Because the risk of trying to like architect the curve so that it kind of fits somewhere different is it's just going to get out of date again. And that's in most other metrics, you can solve that problem by like indexing to the league average. You cannot do that with VQS. Like, it says you have to pick a binary number and decide where each thing goes. So I think in theory, great. In practice, it's a tricky metric to work with.
I wonder if there might be a way to somehow give points for outs. But that'd be pretty much the same thing, I guess. So it wouldn't matter. It'd let you make it a little more granular. But
well, then it ruins the point of PQS.
Right, right. Just that's the problem.
Super simple. Right?
Yeah, you just want those binary results, as you said, and you don't want it to grade anything in there. Do you think it's going to have to be re-revised sort of regularly? As I mean, we're starting to see the possibility that teams are going to increasingly use the opener type things or these kind of hybrid things where you know, what do they call them? Like handcuffing two guys. It's not what they call it, but 3 innings each for the first
primary
two guys.
Primary pitcher and whatnot. So the previous effort at least somewhat didn't look at that specifically, but at least got rid of the, if you pitch less than 5 innings, it's an automatic 0. Like that's no longer a rule. And I think that's a good rule because there are going to be a lot of starts that are like 4 innings or something like that.
High design in a lot of instances.
Yeah, exactly. And if you still get 6 strikeouts and you only walk 2 guys and give up any home runs, like that's not a disaster. Like maybe that was a disaster 20 years ago.
Right.
But now it's okay. You can live with that. You didn't get your win, but so be it. It was still an okay performance. I think a trickier thing is like who even gets put into the PQS like bucket, right? Cause you mentioned like a primary pitcher, like they don't count. Like they don't get a log entry in the PQS log if they didn't start the game. So I think maybe that's a more interesting way to look is like, should we actually just be like giving someone who was the primary pitcher, like a PQS score, even though they came in the second inning, they pitched the second inning through the 6th inning. And then they did really, really well. I'm trying to think of a live example, like maybe Nick Pivetta last year probably had more PQS logs in theory than he actually ended up having on paper because he was he came in behind another pitcher for some of those.
Yeah, I wonder if that creates like a data gathering problem for whoever's doing it, because now the data gathering process has to figure out, regardless of when the innings took place, if he got 4, we're counting them. But how do you find that out? You can't. You can find it out by looking at a box score with your eyes, but I'm just thinking about trying to program it into a data gathering thing. I guess you could if you had.
Yeah, access. We would know if the game was started or whatnot. I don't know. Maybe the right answer is some merge of what we think of as PQS. You had done some pure quality relief stuff for forever ago.
Yeah,
maybe there's some sort of like pure quality outing, pure quality appearance thing that kind of blends the two worlds together, and I don't know, maybe there's something there. I'll put it on my list.
Yeah, something else to add to the list. Ed, in addition to directing the research department, you also do your own research. And just before spring training of last season, you published a research article looking at playing time, and that's been updated in the Baseball Forecaster this year. So why did you decide, first of all, to undertake research on this topic? Because it's really important in fantasy baseball.
It actually stemmed from one really specific thing that has driven me crazy for forever, which is projections of players, and also just even in hindsight, is you see these plate appearance totals and you really just weren't sure, like, was that over a full season or were they injured for part of that season? Like, what did 500 plate appearances mean? Was it, you know, basically full time for two thirds of a, you know, or three quarters of a year, or was it like three quarters of the time for the whole year? So that's always driven me crazy, again, both in hindsight and in projections. So the missing concept there was the concept that I introduced called active weeks, which is very, very simply, was the player on the major league roster as of, you know, the call it Monday of that week. I've relaxed that a little bit just because it makes more scalable data processing. But basically, were they on the team's active roster in the early part of that week of the season? If so, they get a one for that week. If not, they get a zero for that week and their stats don't count. So everything from there, kind of to your point early on in the conversation, kind of stems back to like controlling for active weeks. And once you control for active weeks, you can uncover this entire universe of other playing time metrics, which opens up lots of paths to new insights.
The result of the original work, Ed, was six new metrics. And they kind of, as we talked about earlier, the first one became a component of the second one, which became a component of the third one and so forth. So how do fantasy managers use the metrics?
Well, I think that's largely still a story to be told, is how fantasy managers use these metrics. I know I've gotten a lot of great feedback from the HQ community as well as some of our industry colleagues. And my hope is that these metrics will be pretty ubiquitous, maybe not even only at HQ, but elsewhere as well. And I think that is because they have pretty significant utility. So again, once you control for active weeks, the kind of counterpart to active weeks is plate appearances per active week. You basically have active weeks times plate appearances per active week, plus this one extra little thing called ghost plate appearances, which we can get into if you want. But those two things combined basically tell a more, much more rich and interesting story about a player's playing time than just simply their total plate appearances for the year. So you can have a lot of players that when they play, like when they were on the roster, like their plate appearances per week, per active week, were just huge. But for whatever reason, could be an injury, could be a late call up. There's probably some other reasons in there as well. They weren't actually on the roster for a full season. But those players are really, really interesting because they've already established really, really strong playing time. And all they have to do to be that like 650 plus, 700 plus plate appearance player in a subsequent season is just play as much as they've already established as they are able and willing to play, or the managers are able and willing to play them over the full season. So players like that for this year include players like Zach Geloff, include players like Matt McClain, Ellie De La Cruz, who you might have other opinions on for other reasons, but from a pure playing time perspective, they were pretty strong stalwarts in 2023 and, you know, probably bodes well going into 2024. And I'm happy to break down those metrics further if you want.
Well, it's funny. The next thing on my list, it says, what are ghost plate appearances and why do they matter?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short answer is they probably don't matter too much, but they definitely matter to make the math work out. So ghost plate appearances are basically, so I can talk about some interesting concepts though. So ghost plate appearances are basically the player was an inactive week, right? So they weren't on the team, called usually like an IL stint, right? So like they were still on the IL on Monday and on Tuesday and on Wednesday, but they came back on Thursday, for example, right? So yes, it's a little tricky if you're in a format where you're allowed to start players for the back half of the week. So that probably further minimizes ghost plate appearances. But in a world where you have to start players just once per week, you know, if the player played in reality, but you would have never started them as a fantasy player because they were still on the IL. You didn't know if they were going to come off or whatnot. So these are plate appearances that accumulate, but were not really realized by fantasy managers. And it's usually like because the player was shuttled up and down, or I think for more fantasy relevant players, they were often on and off the IL. But over the course of a season, you might lose 5 or 10% of your plate appearances to this kind of like ghost plate appearance world where you might have had 400 total. I think it was like maybe Luis Robert, 2 years ago, you know, might have had like 400 plate appearances. But as a fantasy manager, which was bad enough because you're hoping for 550 or six or whatever, he only got 400 by the book, and he really only got about 360 for you. You know, in reality, when you could have actually used him. So his season was worth even less to you.
Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense to me. Another reason that pops into my head is maybe you got a platoon guy and Monday and Tuesday or whatever the threshold is, they didn't play Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they were right-handers and he's platooning against and sitting against right-handers. And then he gets three left-handers for the rest of the week and none of them count because you can't put them on your roster for a whole week on the basis of thinking he's only going to play twice.
Right. So in that particular case, that probably would not count towards as a ghost plate appearances, but that's definitely a thing. And that's part of what some of the other research I've done in the Forecaster that will also be published on the site soon is looking at like handedness splits and things like that, where a lot of that stuff kind of pops.
So after applying this analysis, which players or player types are good to add to our watch lists as the kind of reliable playing time producers that we can count on to keep delivering the goods for fantasy purposes?
Yeah, I'll go with patterns, right? So I think some of the patterns that are the most interesting as you kind of go from season to season. Well, certainly like just finding players that are like are truly like really stable across the board in all of the kind of sub metrics of playing time are really interesting, right? So you want players that have high starts per active week, which is SAW in my metrics, that already have like really high plate appearances per start, and they seem at not much risk of like kind of going down the lineup or things like that. Players that have really strong like games percentage of games started versus both left-handers and right-handers. So one of the things that I uncovered in the more recent bout of research was that almost every major leaguer has some degree of platoon split, right? So like it's not just the Jock Petersons of the world or the Rob Refsnyders of the world or Eddie Rosarios of the world. It's like every player has some material platoon split. Like very, very few, like maybe just one, actually starts 100% of games against both left-handers and right-handers. There's a lot of like, oh, I start 96% of the games versus right-handers and 78% of the games versus left-handers. I just described Corbin Carroll. I start 800% of the games versus left-handers and only 85% of the games versus right-handers. If my memory serves me correctly, I think I just described Tommy Edman. So again, going back to your question, like as a pattern, like finding players that are just like stalwarts across the board that don't really have any of those weaknesses is one thing. And those are the players you can really like feel like you can bank on. But in terms of like, where's maybe some value in playing time metrics, I think a couple of key places to maybe find value. One, we already kind of talked about, which is players that have really high plate appearances per active week, but low active weeks in the prior season. I have found that the correlation from 1 year to the next on the metric of plate appearances per active week is very, very high. It's actually more correlative with total plate appearances than total plate appearances itself, right? So if you're looking for a single metric to like anchor yourself on is look for people that have established this pattern of really strong playing time when they are in the lineup. Conversely, active weeks among players that are like, call it like fantasy relevant players, has almost no correlation with itself from year to year, right? So what you really want to find are people with really, really high plate appearances per active week, and maybe players that missed some active weeks. It could be they could have 24, maybe they had one short IL stint, maybe they only had 15, like in the case of, I think, Matt McClain, or Ellie had 17 or something like that. But if those players jump to 27 active weeks, which is the modern kind of max, and they still get all of the same kind of plate appearances per active week, they're going to get 650 plate appearances. So it seems crazy to just like project that for someone, but not really. If you just look at the metrics, you're not projecting anything crazy. You're saying, here's a stable metric. They've already done this. Here's an unstable metric. Like, just give them the boost on the unstable metric, which is pretty random, and you're very likely to come out ahead. So again, I already listed some players out: Gelof, McLean, Riley Green's on the list, Vinny Pasquantito's on the list. Again, I'm just going by memory here, but there's a lot of really interesting players that you can find. So in the back of the forecaster, you see lists that you can see those details, and hopefully on the site. I was hoping to have done it before we talked today, but you should also have a nice tool on the BHQ site as well that will let you kind of float these players right to the tops of your list.
Played 100% against left-handers and right-handers. Got to be Marcus Semien.
Yeah, he's the only one. And even, but it's really interesting, right? So is he going to keep doing it? I don't know. Maybe he's a unicorn. But even all the other players that you think of as like top of the top, it's like, all right, it's 98 versus righties and 92 versus lefties. And like, if you look at, so one of the other things I did in the forecaster was aging curves on percent games started versus same-handed pitching and percent games started versus opposite-handed pitching. And versus opposite-handed pitching is pretty stable versus same-handed pitching is a really big drop-off. So another one of the patterns that I would kind of urge people to think about is that very thing, specifically for and the curve drops off pretty materially right around age 32. So watch out for those league average age 32 right-handed hitters who might just lose another 8, 10, 12, 15% of games started versus right-handers, which could take them from being pretty fantasy relevant to less fantasy relevant, maybe above average to below average, maybe worth an 8th round pick to maybe only worth a 14th round pick. So I think that's a pretty real thing for people to be cognizant of.
You mentioned the correlative value of certain things when you looked at these players over last season to this one. Is there any thought of going back further into history and assessing all the, you have pretty much the same availability of data for previous years to get a stronger sense of correlation over a longer time span?
Yeah. Well, so just to be super clear, this is based on 5 years of data. So this is 2019 through 2023. What I like about these metrics now, it is a little tricky because it's all based on game logs and lineups. And while those things are theoretically immutable data points, they do have some errors in them, right? So like every back data season that you want to add, it might be 97, 98% right, but you still have to kind of go through and do some data cleanup. So 5 years felt about right in terms of like, give me a nice stable set of data, but without having to like go on to Baseball Reference and look at the actual lineup for an actual game and replace all the entries with the right things. Because any data source has its little bugaboos that you have to find. So yeah, anyways, 5 years of data, all these metrics are based off of that.
And for our amateur researchers listening, are the data stored at Baseball Reference? Is that where you're getting them from, or is some
Everything we're baseball? Using is all in our, so Baseball HQ has a baseball info system and baseball info solutions feed. So it's basically game log data and lineup data from there, and then just other just kind of general stats.
So the short answer is, if you're an amateur researcher, then you probably don't have access to the data that you're using because it's proprietary and we're paying for it.
Right. Well, I will say this. When I did this the first time, I cleverly got data from the MLB Stats API by converting their data on that you can kind of just get by hitting up their web endpoint and doing some clever stuff with it. And then similarly, I think I was able to get like game started data for hitters, which wasn't available in an easy way from Baseball Reference. And I don't remember, and I don't think I even needed to get the lineup data at that point. So like, there are ways to get at this stuff. I've just done it. And so that's often what you do when you're trying to do research the first time, is you'll take whatever you can get, however you can get it. And then once I did the first wave of research and realized that it had legs, then it becomes time to let's find a more stable, scalable way to do this, which is what we did in round two.
You said that the guys to look at would be You mentioned Matt McClain and Ellie De La Cruz because their plate appearances were kind of disguised by the fact that they didn't start the season. They came in week 4 or 9 or whatever it was. Are there any indicators from the longer term analysis that indicates players to avoid?
It's interesting. So I mentioned the one of the patterns, right? Which is, again, beware of, like, you know, kind of starting to age players who maybe have are right-handed, age 32 or above. Like, that's not great. But in general, but they're not always like that. So a player that I picked on in the book was Ha-Seong Kim. And there are a lot of players like Ha-Seong Kim that you can look at. And it's really just understanding, like, how did he get what he got? And if you look at it, he got the plate appearance total that he got last year, which was, I believe, a career high, because he basically batted leadoff against lefties, which was maybe deserving. He also batted leadoff a lot against righties, which was very much not deserved if you just look at it. And if you think about all these metrics, right? So you bat leadoff, you get more plate appearances per start. You maybe, you know, hit above your skis, if that's even a phrase, and you manage to kind of convince your manager or whatever to kind of keep letting you play at a certain lineup spot. But if those two things kind of fail to be true, and some of your lineup itself, your teammates that are surrounding you start to lose some of their goodness as well. Let's call it, you lose Juan Soto. So that's less likely that the lineup turns over as frequently. So, like, there's so many ways for someone like Ha-Seong Kim to not get as much playing time as he got last year. There's nothing specific about him. It's just like these metrics show you like story about that player. So you don't have to go and read everything there is to read about a player like Ha-Seong Kim. You just look at a simple row of data and you're like, okay, like what is the likelihood I think that all of those things will remain true, even just to get what he got last year? You might only put that at 50-50. And then you might say, like, to do better than that, I think there's maybe 10% chance he does better. And then you assign a 20% probability of doing a little worse and another 20% probability of doing much worse. And you just, like, let all the math play out. And that's not complicated math. And you're going to end up maybe at a plate appearance total that is like 40 or 50 less than he got last year. And you look at his draft price, and if you're me, you want no part of Ha-Seong Kim. You might take him if he fell to the 9th round in a 15 team league, but not in the 6th or the 5th. And again, so I don't have a list of such players, but like the metrics tell you these stories just by looking at them. And then you can apply your own intuition as a fantasy manager, which is kind of the fun part. I mean, yeah, sure, projections are great, but it's not fun to just like draft the highest guy on the projected list. It's more fun to like think about a player. And again, this lets you do that at scale, because you don't have to go and read every last thing there is to read about every player. You just look at this little metrics grid, and it tells you the playing time story for sure.
Yeah, it's a really interesting study. It's presented really interestingly too, with those little pie chart graphs that are, each guy's got a little pie chart graph that shows whether he's kind of 25%, 50%, those kinds of things.
Yeah, so we may not keep those long-term. Yeah, those are like what they call them, like little Harvey balls. That was kind of like to give people a sense of the benchmarks. Uh-huh. I don't know, PD, if you like them, maybe we'll bring them back. But yeah, they're nice because you can get a sense for, like, as you're learning a new metric, right? Like, is 5.5 starts per week good? Is it not good? Is 4.8 good? Is it not good? And those little fill in the circle to, you know, 100%, 0.75%, 50%, whatever, that can really help you when you're evaluating a new metric and get a sense of its scale. So maybe we'll bring it back.
It's interesting that I've done some data presentation courses when I was working, especially at that company where, hey, you can do Excel? All right. You know, so I could go to my boss and say, you know, there's this course. Yeah, okay, here's $700 or whatever it was. And I've also read a lot of Edward Tufte's work on data presentation. For sure. And he hates pie charts. And I hate pie charts. And I hated them before I read the books, because I just don't think we're equipped mentally to look at a circle that's divided into chunks and be able to make any use of the size of the chunks because, you know, there's the pi r squared problem and then they're all pointy non-square things that you're trying to look at.
Yeah.
And so, but I think the, these little Harvey balls, did you call them?
Yeah, I think that's what I'm going by a 20-year-old consulting memory, but I think that's what they're called. They're not pie charts. You scared me first. I'm like, I don't think I made a pie chart because I also hate pie charts. I also read Tufte. So yeah.
But they're not pie charts really. They're just icons of a quarter, half,
three quarters. So,
yeah. Well, Ed, I could go on and talk to you for hours about this, and I hope over the course of the season I'll get back to you a few times because this is so interesting. And I think for anybody who's serious about playing fantasy, people who are playing for money for fantasy need to know this stuff because they're partly foundational valuation things, but there's also a lot of marginal value in identifying guys who are sneakily headed in the right direction or sneakily not headed in the right direction. And these data that you present, I think, really afford fantasy managers insight into both the large picture and the small picture possibilities. And I think it's really valuable for that reason. I appreciate it. Remind our listeners where they can keep up with your work.
Well, you can find my work at baseballhq.com. You can find my work in the Baseball Forecaster. You can find my every once in a while posts on X at edecaria, E-D-E-C-A-R-I-A. That's about where you can find my stuff on fantasy baseball.
Well, as I said, Ed, it was really a pleasure to talk with you. I enjoyed it. I learned a lot, and that's all you can ask. So I appreciate it. Thanks very much, and we'll have you again later in the season.
Awesome. Thanks, PD.
And that's Baseball HQ Radio for Tuesday, March the 19th. Thanks very much for taking the time to download and listen to show number 7 of the 2024 fantasy baseball season. I also want to thank our guest experts for this Two Tout Tuesday edition, Nick Pollock from PitcherList.com and Ed DeCaria, the Director of Research at BaseballHQ.com. Nick is a top-notch baseball researcher, very innovative guy, and a successful entrepreneur. And Ed is an innovative fantasy baseball researcher in his own right and a great guy to have a conversation with. I'm Patrick Davitt, the host of Baseball HQ Radio. I hope to see you on the BaseballHQ.com subscriber forums. And remember, you can stay in contact with Baseball HQ on Facebook and on our Twitter feed at Baseball HQ. You can also follow my personal Twitter feed at Patrick Davitt, where you'll always be the first to know when a new podcast is available. Please tell your friends about Baseball HQ Radio. Take a second to go to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, wherever you catch your pods, and leave Baseball HQ Radio a good review and rating. It really does help us find new listeners, and new listeners help us keep the podcast going. If your pod getter of choice doesn't find Baseball HQ Radio, let us know about that or anything else on your mind by emailing bhqradio, all one word, at gmail.com. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back again Friday with another Friday Full Edition featuring Paul Sporer from Fangraphs and the Sleeper and the Bust podcast. And in the weeks ahead, we'll have more guest experts, including Mike Gianella from Baseball Prospectus. And we have our season opening roundtable edition with Ray Murphy of BaseballHQ.com and Todd Zola from Masters Ball, ESPN, RotoWire, and SiriusXM. Plus, we'll have all the usual great stuff, our news analysis, our Baseball HQ commentaries, all that great stuff, and Paul Sporer on next Friday's full edition of the podcast with Fantasy Baseball Intelligence for Winners. It is Baseball HQ Radio. We'll talk with you again on Friday, and for now, so long.
Baseball HQ Radio is a weekly free podcast available through iTunes and other podcast aggregators, or directly from baseballhq.com, where we have an archive of past shows as well. Just look for the HQ Radio microphone logo on the right side of the baseballhq.com homepage. Baseball HQ Radio is a production of the USA Today Sports Media Group. The opinions expressed on Baseball HQ Radio are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of the USA Today Sports Media Group. The program is produced and edited by Patrick Davitt.